Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is actor Melvin Douglas. Born in 1901, Douglas appeared in a Shakespearean repertory company while still in his teens. After serving his country in World War I, Douglas moved on to Broadway and then the movies, making his screen debut in 1931 in Tonight or Never opposite Gloria Swanson. Within just a few years, he would star alongside such luminaries as Claudette Colbert, Greta Garbo, Boris Karloff, Fay Wray, Mary Astor, Irene Dunne, Spencer Tracy, Deanna Durbin, and Merle Oberon. He would reteam with Garbo for the 1939 smash Ninotchka, and then once again in 1941's Two-Faced Woman, whose box office failure was so upsetting to Garbo that it drove her into early retirement, never returning to the silver screen. Douglas played a supporting role in 1948's Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, which he managed to steal away from its leads, Cary Grant and Myrna Loy. He continued to work on Broadway as well as in the new medium of television, but continued to deliver memorable performances in films like 1963's Hud, for which he won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar. As he got older, Douglas held his own against the newest crop of Hollywood stars like Gene Hackman, 1970's I Never Sang From My Father, Robert Redford, 1972's The Candidate, and Burt Lancaster, 1977's Twilight's Last Gleaming. Now almost 80, Douglas would earn a second Best Supporting Actor Oscar for 1979's Being There opposite Peter Sellers. After appearing with George C. Scott in the horror film The Changeling, he co-starred along fellow legends Fred Astaire, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and John Houseman for what would be his final film, 1981's Ghost Story. And who better to discuss Ghost Story and the career of Melvin Douglas than actor, producer, director, author of the new book Connecticut in the Movies, and granddaughter of Melvin Douglas, Ileana Douglas. Hi, Ileana.
Hi there. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much for being here. This is a real honor. I've been seeing you in TV and movies for a long time, and so I'm just so thrilled to be talking to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I remember, I'll tell you, back I saw Cape Fear in the theater, and my friends and I were kind of yelling at you to not go home with Max Cady. We were like,
oh, that's the point.
Don't do it.
Well, that's one of my, you know, my grandfather gave me a book called The Men. Think of the title. It's called The Men Who Made the Movies. Mm. And, but it was all the great directors of the day, Howard Hawks, because he knew I loved acting in movies. Howard Hawks, Hitchcock, and in the hit, what I remembered most, and the book is by Richard Schickel, what I remembered most in the Hitchcock section was this explanation of, you know, putting a bomb under the table and then having the scene go on completely natural, and so that the audience therefore would be like, what are you talking? Get out of the room. Don't you know there's a bomb? So these things kind of stayed with me. And then when I did Cape Fear, because the script was, you know, sort of in flux and they were rewriting it, originally the script was more about, you know, she's like the office tramp who gets what's coming to her, a little bit more like the first version of the film. And so I always thought it was more fun to do that Hitchcock thing of, like you said, you know, doesn't she know that she's not supposed to go home with him? But it was fun to experiment with things that, you know, you see successfully worked. Although I can't watch the movie. It's too scary.
I can understand that. So, anyway, I'm just so excited to be talking to you about your grandfather's work. This is just such a, I'm just so thrilled to be able to talk to you about the great career that your grandfather had. But of course, as I mentioned in the intro, you have a new book out and we need to talk about that first, which is called Connecticut in the Movies. And so, I mean, I'm sure you've been asked this already a bunch of times, but like, you know, what was the impetus for that? We knew you grew up there, but what was the impetus? Because I think to a lot of people who don't live in Connecticut, never lived in Connecticut like myself, we don't have much of a view of Connecticut. It doesn't seem to have an identity.
Yes.
The way, you know, I'm from New Jersey. If they made New Jersey in the movies, it would just be mob movies. You know, yeah. I mean, everybody knows what that is. So, I mean, what was the idea for Connecticut in the movies?
Well, it was, It was exactly what you're saying. You know, over the years, Robert Mitchum was born in Connecticut. Ernest Borgnine, Katharine Hepburn, of course. Gretchen Mol is from Connecticut. Seth MacFarlane is from Connecticut. Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men, went to Wesleyan University. Mad Men, it is very similar to the films that I call Dark Suburbia, Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. Ilya Kazan made films here, lived here. Arthur Miller lived here. He married Marilyn Monroe in Roxbury. You know, there were all these. Janet Leigh and Tony Curtis got married in Connecticut. Jerry Lewis was their best man. Its proximity to New York made it, Hollywood could create anything in Connecticut because it was close to New York. You know, in the film Pillow Talk, Rock Hudson is seducing, you know, Doris Day, and he's got a little country place where in Connecticut, like you said. Somehow, if he said New Jersey, it would be like, okay, I'm not going to New Jersey. But it becomes shorthand. And I always use the example of the film, the Alfred Hitchcock film Rope, in that Rope is based on the Leopold and Loeb murder case, which took place in Chicago. And yet in the film Rope, he has the two students going to Yale. And after they kill their fellow classmate, where are they going to bury the body? At their mother's estate in Connecticut. So somehow, why did he do that? Why did he think that it was more sinister to make them wealthy, upper class, you know, Ivy League students, as opposed to what they really were in Chicago? And so, as you, to your point, I think that because people don't know exactly, you know, about it, that therefore screenwriters can use it to connote very idyllic things like Christmas in Connecticut or Holiday Inn, or very dark things. And somewhere in between is the real Connecticut. And that's what I sought out to, you know, to capture.
One of the things that I learned from your book, and I have a bunch of things about the book after I read it, I wanted to talk to you about, but one of the things that I noted was, and I think it's your fellow Trailer from Hell guru, Larry Karaszewski, who said there were more James Bond parody movies than there are James Bond movies. Uh-huh. And that there were more dark suburbia Connecticut movies than there are light suburbia Connecticut movies. Like, you know, like I was like, wow, the inverse of the cliche has now become the dominant thing, because there were way more dark suburbia movies. And I knew some of them that you mentioned in your book, Ice Storm, things like that. But like, wow, I was like, there's dozens of these things. Some of these I'd never even heard of.
There were so many that's why I agree. I thought, I have to do this as a subgenre, is that we have to do dark suburbia, which for me begins with The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit and The Swimmer and this film called Loving. And then what I call dark suburbia redux, which is a modern reinterpretation of the past, which is even darker than the actual dark suburbia. And that's where you get films like The Ice Storm, like Revolutionary Road, Rachel Getting Married, you know, films like that, Far From Heaven, Todd Haynes film, in which suburbia is now a prison. It's a beautiful prison, but it's a modern interpretation, you know, of the past, where we're making a little bit more of a modern awareness of how miserable these people are. Now, whether that's accurate or not, you know, I don't know. It's fascinating to me, but it could be said that it's a shade, you know, it's a shade too dark. The people they live in these incredible houses and they're all kind of miserable, you know. They're beautifully staged. The art direction is impeccable. And I guess you could almost classify Mad Men in that, you know, I didn't write about TV films, but in that same genre. It's like everyone's wearing these fabulous clothes and they're really miserable. And in every film, there's a lot of reflections and looking at themselves, and their lives are empty, and suburbia is just abysmal. And so it's this road trip movie. That's what was so fascinating about the book was, as you said, uncovering, oh my God, there's so, you know, there's, how do you classify all these different movies, and how do you get from, how did we get from Blandings, which was idyllic, my dream house in the country away from the city, how did we go from that to suburbia is death? And nowadays in a contemporary world, you know, what is suburbia anymore? You know, so that sort of fascinated me too.
I feel like you just happened to mention it in the rope synopsis where you're talking about the mother's estate. Like everyone in Connecticut has an estate, not just a house, an estate. You know? They're looking out a big bay window over their lake, but they're very sad. You know? That's kind of what's going on up there. How did you, I mean, I'm sure some of these movies, I mean, you know this stuff backwards and forwards, but like, how did you go to even compiling it? Because one of the things that I got from, again, reading your book, and I feel like this is something you get from any good film book or any good documentary, is you walk away from it saying, geez, I have a list of things I want to see now. Because there were a good chunk of the movies in your book that I've never even heard of, not seen, literally never heard of, like the Jack Lemmon, Doris Day movie, It Happened to Jane. And I was like, there's a movie with Jack Lemmon and Ernie Kovac. How have I not heard of, like, how did you go about compiling it? Just to, because a lot of these films are not on home video or anywhere. So I mean, how did you?
And that was challenging because, you know, when I initially started the book, I said, you know, I knew I was going to write about, I thought I was going to begin with William Gillette because he's very important in terms of Connecticut. Nobody knows who William Gillette is. You know, William Gillette was an actor from Connecticut. He was kind of discovered by Mark Twain, and Twain convinced him to go. So he's a true, you know, Connecticut person that people should know about. And he created what we now know as the modern persona of Sherlock Holmes. So everything that we saw, that the coat, the hat, the pipe, Elementary, My Dear Watson, that all came from the actor William Gillette. That came from him. He invented, you know. And so the book, I wanted to, again, make the statement that, you know, he really needs to be credited more as this, you know, creating this persona. But then as I got into it, I said, oh my God, they were doing all these silent. I started to find out there were all these other silent films made in Connecticut. I didn't cover all of them, but I said, I'm going to stick with, you know, D.W. Griffith, because he's the sort of the most important. You can go down a rabbit hole. And then, you know, as I went again progressively through the 40s, 50s, 60s, when we get into the 80s, you know, is a movie like Jaws worth mentioning because one of the characters says
he mentions Connecticut, right?
He mentions he goes to Trinity College and his parents live in Greenwich. You know, it starts to become then a different kind of a book.
Right.
Or, you know, do you mention Beetlejuice just because they say they're in Connecticut when they really shot the movie in Vermont? It starts to become so confusing that it, for me, that was, it becomes, unless there's a real. And then what I would do is I'd say, okay, well, let me look up the actors. Is there any kind of real tie? If there's not like a real strong tie back to Connecticut, I just didn't, you know, choose to include it. You know, I wrote about a lot of Robert De Niro films, but, you know, there was a movie that he did that's it's a straight-to-video movie. And, okay, they shot a couple interior scenes in New Haven. It's what do you write about? You know, then you're just writing then you're just doing an IMDb list. Right. And so, you know, for me, it's a road trip story. We're stopping here. In some films too, I spent Like I write a lot about this film, and some films, you know, in the chapter called Connecticut Cameos, it's where it's almost like a trick, you know, like the movie It's a Wonderful Life is a perfect example. You know, that how does Connecticut appear in It's a Wonderful Life? Well, the bell that she says every time an angel gets its wings, that bell was made in East Hampton, Connecticut, the Bevan's Bells. And it was once a big manufacturing town, you know, bell, where all the bells came from. There's only one company left in the world, in Connecticut, and it's Bevan's Bells, and they supplied the, you know, the bell for It's a Wonderful Life. So that for me is compelling because it's a little, it's a tie to a film that is such an iconic film. And so that's a fun way to get, you know, to get Connecticut in there because I also wanted people in the state, and I feel this about all the states. I mean, I've traveled so much, you know, to embrace what you have, what the state has, and the history of the state. And how do you tell the history of the state through these different films? And when did they get it right? And when did they get it wrong? And what is positive about Connecticut? What's negative? You know, and I do a lot. I mean, it's a road trip, you know, so I try to pack a lot into each film, hopefully.
Back when I worked at a video store in the 90s, we had a shelf of film reference books and Leonard Maltin, Roger Ebert, you know, the usual suspects.
Yes.
And it made reading the book again made me flash back to those times where I'm like, if this book had existed or back then, or conversely, video store still existed and I still worked there, it's like I know what I would have done. I would have gotten this book. And we would have made a little shelf of all the movies we had from your book. And I would have like gotten out like a little piece of like cardboard and cut like the state out of it, made a little diagram and put it up there because it would have been like a little theme. And it made me long for those days of like, oh, wow, you could, you know, present, dig out a movie that nobody like loving. You know, that's a film that I had heard of, but I've never seen. And I'd sort of forgotten about it. And then like, oh, now I want to see it. You know, your description was so compelling that I'm like, oh, geez, I want to watch this now. Let's see
Well,
this
that's
movie.
great. I mean, that's what I want to do is shine a light on these films that are great films. So it's, you know, it's a book for movie lovers who want to discover, you know, spend an afternoon with me saying, you know, I grew up here. This is what I think the best of Connecticut is. This is what I think the state stands for, both good and bad. And this is the represent, you know, the this is the representation. And there were some movies, like I said, that I just felt like I didn't include them because I didn't think they were very good, and that's tough to say because I like to be, because to me, anyone who makes any kind of movie, it's so difficult to make a movie. I would really want to include it, but it's hard. It makes it tough then because I'm recommending a film simply because, okay, it's based on a real story, but I don't think it's necessarily, you know, very good.
Right. All right, on the flip side of that, was there a film that you discovered? Thanks to having to dig it up for the book, that you were like, wow, this is amazing. How have I never seen this to this point?
Well, I would have to say the most shocking film that I discovered was The Secret Life of an American Wife. If somebody can, it, there's, you know, I bought a copy of it on eBay, and I don't even know how I found out about it. I had never heard of it, but it is one of the most subversive films, written by George Axelrod, who of course screenwriter of Manchurian Candidate and Breakfast at Tiffany's, but then also Lord Love a Duck, which is a really avant-garde film. And this movie just goes there. This is in my chapter called, you know, 60s, the sex comedies, which all seem to take place in Connecticut. But Anne Jackson, who is married to Eli Wallach, is a, you know, bored Connecticut housewife, and her husband works for a famous movie star. They originally wanted Frank Sinatra to play the part, which he wasn't going to play it, and so they got Walter Matthau. So he doesn't even have a name; he's the movie star. And Patrick O'Neill, is the husband who later shows up in Stepford Wives. Part of his job, I mean, this is right in the movie. His job is that every day at 1 o'clock in the city, Walter Matthau sleeps with a call girl. He gets her a call girl to sleep with. That's, you know, that's his proclivity. And Ann Jackson feels unsexy, and because she's, you know, she explains in the beginning, I warned my husband, you know, if we move to Connecticut, I'll have that Connecticut look. And so she pretends she's a call girl and goes to New York and, you know, tricks Walter Matthau and pretends she's a call girl. And they have this affair, and she comes home all perked up and she's ready to go back into her marriage. And I was like, wow, there's no veneer in this movie. This is not, you know, whereas all the other sex comedies are kind of coy and they flirt around the idea of infidelity, like Rally Round the Flag Boys, mm-hmm. Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. They flirt around the idea, and, you know, neighbors, you know, sexy neighbors, people drinking too much. There's a lot of drinking in the sex comedies. But this one is like, becomes a very serious film where both Walter Matthau and Ann Jackson have this affair in the afternoon, and both have this exchange and, you know, talk to each other. He learns things about her, you know, and she learns things from him, and it becomes kind of a quite serious film. And it'd be great to see if it weren't such a terrible copy, you know. Mm-hmm. But I would say that was one of them that was really a surprise to me, a revelation.
I really want to see it. Partly just because it's Walter Matthau. I love Walter Matthau.
Yeah, so, Walter Matthau is always, you know, good. And a great part for Ann Jackson, who, you know, didn't see too much in films.
All right. So before we get to Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, because that is the Venn diagram of this book and your grandfather, just one other thing I wanted to mention. I know you said that you're talking about Mad Men. The book doesn't cover television. That's not what it's about. But I don't know if you ever watched, in case you hadn't seen, I don't know if you ever watched 30 Rock, but there's an episode of 30 Rock where the dimwit actress, Jenna Maloney, leaves the show for a little bit to go shoot a Saw-like horror movie in Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
And the joke of the name of the episode is I Heart Connecticut. And the premise of this whole subplot is that Connecticut is offering tax breaks to filmmakers to come and make a film there, which is why they're making this sort of Hostel / Saw movie. And so in between Jenna Maroney getting potentially tortured by a serial killer, she has to read pages and pages of stuff from the Connecticut Chamber of Commerce talking about how great it is to live in Connecticut. It's an absolutely fantastic bit of in between of just reading about, well, we have wonderful bridges and we have wonderful parks here. And it's all about how Connecticut is willing to put up with this grisly movie just to help sell the idea that you want to come to Connecticut.
You know what? I mean, having not seen the episode, it's interesting because Connecticut has a very long, that was a discovery, long underground history of horror films that were made here. Wes Craven, Last House on the Left. In the 60s, this guy named Del Tenney, who, you know, did these drive-in grindhouse, you know, movies that are really kind of so bad they're good type films, until today. And which I covered today, some modern, you know, really horror movies. There was a very interesting film which I discovered called Deep in the Darkness, which is a zombie, kind of a zombie film set in Moodus. And again, about a, you know, nice couple moving to Connecticut. Zombie. So I wonder if there's a, you know, some element of truth to that. And then a longer discussion about tax credits in various places. In some instances, there are films that are specifically about Connecticut, but they made in, you know, New Jersey, or, you know, because they got a better tax credit. And
right.
And so I write about that. I hope that the book becomes a blueprint you know, so that people, that they expand the tax credit and let people shoot more films here.
Absolutely. So okay, so let's talk about Mr. Blandings,
Sure.
because that's a big part of the book. It's probably, maybe the most famous Connecticut movie, but maybe at least in the early part of the 20th century. It's a, it's a classic. It's a movie that for some reason, when I was a kid, it seemed to be on TV a lot for being an older film. I don't exactly know why, as opposed to some other
Yeah.
films, but it was a movie that I saw multiple times as a kid. And, I rewatched it for the purposes of this show. And, as I was going through your grandfather's filmography and watching movies I hadn't seen, but I was like, all right, I really want to rewatch Blandings. And as I mentioned in the intro, one of the things I was stunned by is that I feel like, and I'm a huge fan of Myrna Loy, and Cary Grant is Cary Grant, but I feel like your grandfather steals that movie away from the two of them, which is not easy to do. But he is so funny in that movie, and he's so wonderful that it's, I came, and he gets the last line in the
Yeah.
movie, gets the very last line. But I mean, good Lord. And it, and in a lot of ways, it is, I think maybe you agree or not, it seems to be like the Connecticut movie for at least many decades, because it is all that stuff you're talking about, the idea of that it's this idyllic suburbia, but there's trouble lurking beneath the surface.
Well, yeah, it's funny you say that because that was one of the discoveries that I had. You know, when you can see a movie, like you said, 20, 30 times. And then when you're writing about the film, you're suddenly looking at it with a more critical eye. And once I got into the history of the film and reading that, you know, my grandfather participated in writing the script. I actually met the script writers when I was a little kid.
Wow.
At, you know, they're a little bit in the book, you know, when you're writing things, you know, you go, well, I can't add every little nuance of the, but I remember meeting the writers. Yeah, and I was excited because they had, you know, worked for Bob Hope. They did the Hope and Crosby movies. But anyway, through my grandfather, I remember meeting them when I was a little kid. But he had worked on the script, and I think he developed, you know, I think he purposely wrote for himself all the funniest lines in the movie. And as you say, not that Cary Grant and Myrna Loy aren't terrific, but he's really the backbone. And that's why I just thought, well, this is so crazy. I'm writing the book, and yeah, there really is this strange tie that I hadn't even expected. And then, you know, my third act is that I'm Mrs. Blandings. Like, that wasn't expected either, that I was going to move back and buy a money pit. And, you know, I was like, okay. And just like Eric Hodgins, the original author, who was, you know, living in New Milford, bought, you know, a house in Connecticut, was fixing it up, and he went bankrupt. He went bankrupt trying to fix up this house. He ended up losing the house. And then he sold you know, when Hollywood bought the rights to the movie, he tried to buy the house back, and he couldn't. They wouldn't let him buy it back. And he never got his dream, you know, so he built this dream house. So then when I found myself, I said, this is really strange. Now I'm writing about the movie, and I'm in a money pit, and the same thing happened to me. And he, Eric Hodgins, said the book is writing itself, and now I'm saying the book is writing itself. And so I don't know, maybe my grandfather is overseeing, you know, all of these things. And as I got into the you start out with the premise of, okay, of course I'm going to write about my grandfather and his funny lines, but then it becomes so deep and so nuanced that I'm writing about myself because I'm Mrs. Blandings, but then also the idea that Mr. Blandings created this image for America that Connecticut was, you know, not only a great place to live, but it was the place to live. You know, it was, you left New York City, you know, your cramped New York apartment for suburbia. And did Hollywood invent suburbia? Well, I think they did. And And to go along with this invention, the film is packed with product placement. They're eating
Right.
Kellogg cereal. The appliances were all provided by GE. One of the things in the movie is apparently it was like the first dishwasher ever made. And GE was upset when they saw the movie because they didn't think they saw enough of the kitchen. So they had to go back, reshoot a scene so you could see more of the appliances. Cary Grant drives a Ford very prominently. It's like we see that Ford again and again. And then when the movie ended, they went on various tours in which they came up with this idea to you could buy a kit house, you could buy a Blandings house, you could buy plans and build a house just like the Blandings did. And there were, about 70 houses throughout America, four of which still exist in Connecticut. And they are replicas of what was built in Malibu, which didn't even have a back. It wasn't a really good one. It's a fake, it's a fake house. It became real. Like they really made plans. In fact, I write about in the book how they realized, like, oh, wait a minute, this is just a set. It doesn't actually have an upstairs. So we need to actually build. We need to build, and these need to be actual plans. And then builders building on the idea of the movie built in their own things, like, a bomb shelter. And they created suburbia. They created this idea of superior living in suburbia. And that's what I talk about is like by the time we get to The Swimmer, it's a deconstruction of suburbia.
Right.
And now, what is, now we don't, what is suburbia? We don't really know. But at the in the late 40s and the 50s, it was really, really important to bring people out of the city and have them live in the country and commute by train to New York. And I just thought it was fascinating, that to write about that culture.
I noticed in the movie that no matter whenever Cary Grant or Myrna Loy or your grandfather are driving, the top is down on their car. And I'm like, well, this is the New England, and the house is taking many, many months to get built. I mean, this isn't Los Angeles. At some point, it's got to get kind of cold, but you'd never know it. Everything just looks sunny and beautiful all the time when they're making the house, even though they're finding the well and the water and all the trouble and everything else. But I just
Yes.
noticed that. I'm like, yeah, they're always driving the top down. It's got to be pretty chilly.
The message of the film, I realized, is just keep spending. Just keep spending and spending and spending. And in the end, it'll be okay. But as I wrote comically in my own journey here, I said I had to keep reminding myself that, Mr. Blandings has a happy ending. But that the but the message of the film, good or bad, is be a consumer. Just keep spending, and we all deserve our dream house, And so what's fun about the book is that it tells the story of William. It starts with William Gillette, who literally with his money built a castle, an actual castle above the Connecticut River, and now it's the same idea. Man's house is his castle, and this idea, that it's a very American ideal that we all want our own house and our dream house. And who created that? I think Hollywood
Wait,
did.
Hollywood, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you I mean, you've written about your grandfather, and you wrote about him in your previous book, I Blame Dennis Hopper. And so of course again he comes up again in this book. But I'm fascinated at the idea of growing up with someone who was a big Hollywood star. Like what an unusual situation that is. What do you remember what age you were when you could was old enough to were you were old enough to figure out what he did for a living? Like wait a minute, that's my grandfather. He's in this thing. Could you reconcile like what that is. I'm seeing my grandfather, but he's pretending to be somebody else.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I spent a lot of time in New York with both my Italian grandparents and then my grandfather. He lived in the Upper West Side, and then they had a place in Vermont. And so it was always going from Queens, you know, New York to the Upper West Side. And I just knew there was a format, you know, he was my grandfather, but there was a certain formality and beauty and aesthetic that I knew that there was something about him that was special, that was unlike my relatives from Queens. That's all I knew, you know.
Right.
But then as I got older and then spending time in Vermont and then all sorts of, it was probably again when famous people would come to visit that I got the understanding of, oh, okay, he's in movies. And then, you know, watching movies on TV and seeing him in movies on TV. I mean, I think, believe it or not, maybe the first movie I saw of him on TV was called Advance to the Rear.
The Glenn Ford, right? Isn't Glenn Ford in
Ford, that? Yes. And I loved, I mean, of course, I love my grandfather, but I developed a big crush on Glenn Ford from that point on. But so I would see him on, you know, movies and TV. But then as I got older and, you know, started letting me visit him on film sets, then wow, that's when I really started. And I think it was with the movie Ninotchka that I really started understanding, like, oh, okay, so he was dead this long, you know, career. Now he's got these different films. And so then we developed more of a communication, because at that point, then I really knew I wanted to go into acting. And I was always, he would send me different movie books. And I was always looking for a way, I guess, to, you know, talk to him about movies that he was in. So that's when I started really kind of understanding, oh, okay, he worked with all these different people. There was a book that came out. I've never seen it again. I've been looking around for it, but he was the only actor, I believe, to have worked with Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, you know, like all the major actresses of the time. And so there were books like that. So it was a combination, again, you know, we didn't have any internet. So it was a combination of movie books, which were so much a part of my childhood, and then actually, you know, kind of talking to him, or, you know, to him taking me to meet various different actors and things like that.
Well, that's okay. It's perfect, because I wanted to ask you about that, about whether he talked to you about being in the movies. But obviously, if he's taking you onto film sets, he very much is. Was he supportive of the idea that you would get into that too? Was he a little leery, like, well, there's some downside to this? I mean, what was his opinion about you doing it?
No, I think it was very leery. You know, from when I was a little kid, I always, you know, I have no, again, I don't really know why, it's a past life thing or whatever, but, you know, I sort of fashioned myself out as if I were some 1930s, you know, Dorothy Parker. I had a little typewriter that I'd set up, and I would, you know, write movie reviews. I have no idea what, you know, but that was always, and I'd send them to him. You know, I'd write these fictional stories about, I just arrived in Hollywood, but, you know, I'm sure they were awful, but he was always very encouraging of my writing. And so he would always send me, you know, various books, things like that to read. But I always secretly really just wanted to be, you know, an actor. But we had, as I wrote in, you know, I blamed Dennis Hopper. He said, well, if you want to be an actor, you have to go into the theater. Well, where am I going to go? Where? I don't have anything. We don't have any theater here. So for me, getting into this theater group, which is called the Hartford Stage Company Youth Theater, even though it was a musical, I was like, I've done it. Okay, I can emulate now his rules, which are, if you want to be an actor, you study, you know, you do something serious and you go on the stage. But we were doing, this is like a funny example of my grandfather is, so I got cast in the musical called Boys from Syracuse, and I was playing the role of the courtesan. I had one big musical number, and my grandfather said, I'm going to have you come. I know you're doing this musical, and so you know, take the train down to New York because I want you to have lunch with Mrs. Mary Rogers, the widow of Richard Rogers. You know, I'm like a little kid. I just had a part, you know. So he would force me into situations which were way, way above my head. I mean, that we now look back on, now I'm laughing. Like, I don't even know how I kept up in the conversation. But, you know, where you would be sitting across from a grown-up, well, I understand you'd like to go into the theater. You're going to be doing one of my husband's plays. And, you know, so I just tried to, you know, come across as if I was some sort of serious actor, even though all I really wanted to do was kind of, you know, sing and dance and be famous. But that was so those are my kind of my favorite memories of my grandfather. I know we're going to get to Ghost Story, but you know, when I was on the set of Ghost Story, it's like, I told Jen Houseman of your interest to be an actor, and so I've arranged for you to do monologues for him. I was like, you know, so that was,
Thanks, Grandpa.
yeah, exactly. I look at it now, I'm like, how the heck did I don't even know I got through these things, but I was like, okay, you bet, I'm gonna be an actor, you know.
That's so
Yeah.
sweet, though. That's so wonderful, you know, that he
I
was that supportive of it. That's great.
yeah, so you know, if that's what you call supportive, it's like, you know, or was he testing me? I don't know, you know, I don't know.
Maybe. Well, it's kind of both, really.
Yeah,
Do you?
I guess. Such a shame. I mean, I would have loved, of course, now that I've had this lengthy career, it would be incredible, of course, to talk to him. He had a lengthy career, you know, with
Sure
lots
did.
of highs and lows. And I don't think he was entirely ever really satisfied with where he, you know, where he was in his career. And you think about it now, you know, now he seems as almost as if he died relatively young compared to some, you know, actors who've lived into their 80s and done other things. But it, you know, it would be incredible, of course, to have you know, had him see me, you know, perform or something like that. So getting to write about him is a great way of honoring him. I think because he always wanted me to be a writer, so somehow I've been able to do both.
It's remarkable to hear that he got the perception he wasn't totally thrilled with his career. I mean, he won two Oscars for Pete's sakes. I mean, that's there aren't that many people that have done that. You know,
I know.
that's you would think that that's an amazing career.
I think that again, actors of his generation, you know, were, they didn't really, you know, what's kind of, it was before we even thought, you know, there was no TCM when he
Right.
was around. You know what I mean? And
Yeah.
so we had, it was just at the beginning of this idea of movies are art, you know, Roger Ebert, and there was no, you know, they just didn't have this appreciation for what they did was so special, you know. And I think that had, you know, had he lived a little longer and seen, you know, again that the his longevity, I've experienced just by the amount of people that I've met, you know, over the years who worked with him and knew him, and just had such, you know, tremendous respect for him.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real part of the joy of doing the show is that it forces me to go through people's filmography and see things that I wouldn't normally just think to sit down and watch. And so I saw a bunch of his movies I had never seen before. That Uncertain Feeling, the Ernst Lubitsch film, which is terrific. I think he's really funny in that. I saw HUD for the first time. I'd never seen HUD,
Oh, HUD.
and he won an Oscar for that. I mean, he's crushes it in that movie up against Paul Newman, I mean, which is no easy task.
Yeah.
And then I watched I Never Sang for My Father, which is a hard watch. Not, yeah. You know, it's a, you know, a base, just a movie about a guy dealing with his elderly parents and the father who is sort of this uncompromising guy and he's failing in his age. And it's, you know, it's a great movie, but it's not the kind of thing you would choose to sit and spend 2 hours with, because it's you can't have, most people have experienced that or will experience it in their life. And he's terrific in that. I mean, he's completely matches Gene Hackman's intensity, which is, yeah, that's not easy to do.
Well, and again, that was a conversation I remember having, because, you know, I asked him, like, well, you know, what actors do you like, you know? And he loved working with Gene Hackman. I don't think he had any disdain for, like, old type of acting, classic acting versus mm-hmm. new actors. I know he loved working with Robert Redford. In fact, it was so great when I got to meet Robert Redford. And I did a little role in the movie Quiz Show, and I had this very small part. And the day we were going to film, I get this, you know, the first AD, like, Mr. Redford would like to talk to you in his trailer, you know. And so we were in there for an hour. He wanted to tell me stories about my grandfather, a candidate. They kept knocking on the door. They were like, Bob, we really didn't need to go. We really need to shoot. And he's like, I'll be there in a minute. He goes, and another thing about, you know, I'm in full 50s makeup. And I was like, all right, I have this tiny part, but man, this is so great. Like, hearing these stories, you know, and just hearing how much he loved working with him. That to me is really, I think he had a very modern style of acting, which comes out again and again. You know, mm-hmm. he doesn't have the formality that some of the actors, sometimes he's mentioned in the same vein of William Powell, which mm-hmm. I find to be, you know, not, William Powell never did theater. I think they're mm-hmm. very, you know, nothing against William Powell, but I think my grandfather was just so much more versatile than mm-hmm. William Powell, so much more, you know, than, because he became a, you know, a character actor, theater actor, etc. And his style of acting, I think, is just so modern.
Yeah, and he fit in all sorts of different movies. I mean, I mentioned he's in The Changeling, which I think is a terrific horror movie. Yeah. But then he's in Being There. You know, he's in a Hal Ashby movie. Two very different kinds of things, and yet he fits. You know, he's great in both those movies. You know, yeah. So I mean, he's able to modulate what he's doing. So, okay, well, let's talk about Ghost Story. It was released on December 18th, 1981. For those of you who have not seen it, I'm just going to do a very brief plot synopsis of it so you know what we're talking about. So in a small New England town, four old friends, businessman Ricky Hawthorne, lawyer Sears James, physician John Jaffrey, and Mayor Edward Charles Wanderley, form the Chowder Society, a private club where they swap horror and ghost stories. Edward's son, David, living in New York, falls to his death after the woman he just slept with turns into a living corpse. Edward then asks his other son, Don, to come home to Vermont. Edward sees what he thinks is his dead son chasing him onto a snowy bridge. He then sees a female apparition and falls to his death. Don, not believing his father died accidentally or due to suicide, tells the three friends a ghost story so he can join the Chowder Society. He relays a story from his past when he fell in love with a woman named Alma. Sensing something amiss about her, Don breaks off their engagement, enraging her. She disappears, only for Don to learn that she is now with his twin brother, David. Don finds an old photo of his father and friends from the 20s, alongside a young woman who looks exactly like Alma. John Jaffrey, scared of what might be happening, begs his friends to tell Don the truth, but they ignore him. The next day, he has a nightmare about Alma and dies of a heart attack. Ricky and Sears finally tell Don the truth, that in 1929, the four friends were all smitten with a woman named Eva. A stupid accident leads them to try and cover up what they think is Eva's death, realizing too late what they have done. Is Alma the reincarnated ghost of Eva out for revenge? Don insists on going to Eva's old house to confront her, but when he is hurt in an accident, it's up to Ricky to face the ghosts of his past. The film stars Fred Astaire in his final film, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. in his final film, John Houseman, Patricia Neal, Craig Wasson and Alice Krieg, as well, of course, as Melvin Douglas. It was directed by John Irvin, who did films like The Dogs of War, Raw Deal, and Hamburger Hill. So, okay, you mentioned being on the set of this film.
Yes. You know, I was absolutely thrilled. You know, my grandfather, I visited previously on the set of Being There.
Wow.
And now this was going to be more of an extended, you know, I could go up for, you know, a couple of days to be on the set. And again, this was part of him. It wasn't just a visit. It was, okay, if you're really serious about this acting thing, you should come up and, you know, see what it's all about. And what's interesting from my perspective, you know, as a kid, was it was an extremely problematic film, which I quickly discovered. You know, the first thing that happened after initially meeting everyone, they'd been in rehearsal, was my grandfather and Patricia Neal, you know, going to the hotel and having room service, and Patricia Neal and my grandfather receiving yellow pages. Now, I didn't know what that meant, and Neal's frustration with the fact that they were getting, you know, that they were elderly, they were getting new scenes written every single day.
Right.
You know, that she had had a stroke.
She was recovering from a pretty, pretty bad stroke.
Exactly. And so for somebody like her, it was very, very difficult and challenging to learn new lines. And so I'm watching this all like in real, it couldn't have been more exciting. I was like, first of all, there's free food, like room, you know, room service, nice hotel, famous people, you know, Patricia Neal. So I was in the thick of watching this discussion, you know, between two old actors. And so, of course, cut to me many years later, being in a hotel room, eating room service, getting yellow pages, experiencing that weird frustration of like, don't they know how hard, how can they hand me a 7-page scene, you know? And so that was its whole own, you know, kind of an interesting thing. I never heard, you know, my grandfather ever say anything directly negative about the director, but I sensed, again, just as a kid, I sensed immediately that there was something, maybe an insensitivity, I guess, to working with the older actors. Mm-hmm. That was another thing that they were talking about, you know, where they kept Fred outside. The day I got there, apparently the day before, they had shot the scene with Fred Astaire, in which he was outside for hours.
Mm.
And he ended up getting a cold, you know, that he eventually, you know, didn't, I think he got pneumonia. I believe
Yikes.
even got pneumonia. But we're talking about a kind of an insensitivity from the director that maybe he wasn't the right, you know, kind of a person. Then cut to being on the set, and I remember seeing Craig Wasson, who I've never met again, mm-hmm. who I've always like, I just thought I'd love to meet him again, because I remember he looked very worried. He looked, you know, he looked concerned. So again, I'm like, I don't know, I'm just observing everybody. So I just remember that he looked kind of worried and harried, and as if maybe things weren't going the way, you know, that he had anticipated. So those are all of my kind of observations. Then, of course, because I'm, you know, I'm with my grandfather, everybody was just so incredibly nice to me and kind to me. Patricia Neal in particular, I have another wonderful memory of being at the hotel, and apparently, I mean, I couldn't sleep because I was so excited. So I remember getting up in the middle of the night, and there was Patricia Neal in her nightgown in the hallway, and she invited me into her room, and, you know, we had a cup of tea.
Wow.
I know, unbelievable. And she was very sweet, and I kind of stayed in touch with her a little bit. It turns out that her husband, Roald Dahl was somehow distantly related to my grandfather in some way.
Wow.
So I remember her telling me about that, but she just couldn't, you know, she couldn't be kinder to me. And so that was, you know, cut to years later, of course, when watching them in HUD, and what a great experience that was. But then I remember, you know, meeting Fred Astaire, because I was upset. My grandfather knew I was obsessed with dancing and Fred Astaire, and meeting Fred Astaire. And he was a little frail at this point.
Sure.
So, I mean, again, sadly, I'm laughing, but it's like the movie probably killed him. You know, he was, because of all the difficulty of some of the scenes, he wasn't probably in the best of health. So I really wanted to kind of, you know, talk to him maybe more, you know, but I didn't get to talk to him that much. I got to meet him and see him, but I could tell, I was like, all right, he seems like he wants to go home to bed.
I mean, it's based on a book by Peter Straub, and the setting is the setting, but it did seem like, to have these four elderly guys doing this, I mean, it did seem like a punishing place to shoot a movie in the brutal Vermont winter, to have these guys out there. I mean, there's that scene with Douglas Fairbanks is out on this bridge, and, you know, I know enough about movie making to know, well, that probably took a couple of days at the minimum. And it's like, he's what, 85, 82, 83 when he's made that? Like, it couldn't have been easy.
I know. That's why I say I wish I could go back as my grown-up self and, you know, talk to my grandfather and just be like, man, yeah, it all happened to me. I've been there. We are outside, and you're all these things that I saw, you know, going from the set of being there, which was like glamour and unbelievable luxury and all the time in the world, like literally spend all day long on one scene until you get right. And, you know, a temple of art to this film where you're like, something doesn't seem to be quite right on this film. You know, those were my kind of observations.
Watching it again, I saw it many years ago, again, back when I was working at a video store, and I watched it then, and I of course rewatched it for this. And my takeaway was, as much as I like, as you mentioned, Craig Wasson, like, I, you know, he had a really great run for a very brief period of time. Four Friends, Body Double, he's in Nightmare on Elm Street 3. I remember him in that. Like, and now he's retired. I found an interview with him where he is retired, and so that's why he's not in anything anymore. And Alice Creech, who I know from playing the Borg Queen in Star Trek First Contact. This is like one of her first films. She goes on to do movies like Chariots of Fire and Barfly. As much as I like them in the movie, and I do, I want more of these four legendary guys.
I know.
And the film doesn't give us that. And I have to figure that's because they were all older, and it was hard probably to have too much of them in the movie. But like Douglas Fairbanks Jr., kind of dies fairly quickly into the film, and I'm like, geez, I really wish I could have seen a couple more scenes of these four guys sitting around a fire telling horror stories, because it's Fred Astaire and it's Melvin Douglas. Like, what an amazing collection of guys. And
so imagine me sitting there off camera with, I mean, I took a picture, which appears in my first book. You know, you saw it. It's a snapshot of them coming back from rehearsal, and I had my little cheap Kodak, and I was like, can I take a picture? Took a picture because, again, it was pre-TCM. We didn't have this idea of like, wow, here are these greats from the studio system era, and they're all in this one film. I don't quite think there was that appreciation, you know, that we now have. And, I remember my grandfather kind of verbally, which he would do sometimes, when he told me the story of the movie, it was so much better than the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, and they formed the chat, you know, like he, it was, I was like, wow, this is going to be amazing. You know, like you said, why didn't they have more of the four you know, the four guys, like that, they're the people you really want to see. You really want to see the veterans, you know, acting up a storm. I mean, when would you get a chance to have Fred Astaire and Melvin Douglas, you know, in the same movie? I would have to say of the four, John Houseman was the most spry of everybody and very kind of verbal and talkative. But again, he was just an actor in this. He wasn't, even though he had a great career as being a producer, he was just very happy to be acting, you know, hamming it up in the film.
He was in like kind of a second wind to his career at that point too, because he had been in The Paper Chase earlier in the 70s, and he was in John Carpenter's The Fog, and all of a sudden he's kind of in a lot of stuff, you know.
He's kind of doing his John Houseman thing, you know, larger than life, you know.
Yeah, it's where it's Spivey Point. He says things very dramatically and things like that. Was your grandfather friends with those guys outside of, you know, in regular life, or was it just, because it's funny for someone like me growing up outside of this stuff and not knowing any of the intricate workings, you kind of assume that everyone knows each other, which is of course not true, just because they were all movie stars around the same time. Although Fairbanks obviously is an earlier vintage than your grandfather and Fred Astaire, but like, was he friends with them, or was it a chance to like, oh, I'm going to, these are guys I don't know that well, even though we all kind of came up at the same time and I get a chance to be in a movie with them?
He was friends with Patricia Neal. I know that they,
sure,
you know, remained friends after being in HUD.
Being in HUD, right? Yeah.
He was not friends with Fred Astaire. Fred Astaire was at a different studio. You know, Fred Astaire was at RKO, and my grandfather was at Columbia and MGM. So maybe they would have crossed paths, but Douglas Fairbanks, same thing. I, you know, crossed paths, but they were not friends. I believe John Houseman, because of the theater connections, that they were more in touch and more contemporaries, and they both lived in New York. Remember, Fairbanks and Fred Astaire both lived in Los Angeles. So they seem to be, you know, pretty chummy.
Did your grandfather seem to have a good time when he was making the film? Even if he was a little skeptical of how it was coming out, was at least the process for him kind of a fun experience?
Yeah. I mean, again, my recollection is, you know, as I look back in astonishment, he never complained. He never said anything about all these, you know, different, the amount of pages or the amount of work that he had to do, you know, again and again. They you know, they would say, oh Mel, you know, you don't have to do that again if you don't want to, and he would do it. So I think that, again, even though he didn't talk about acting that much, I think he really loved, you know, acting and working on a character and being in films, you know, more than he expressed. But that was, again, part of that generation, I think, to downplay their, you know, their careers, or they didn't talk about acting very, you know, very seriously. But yet, as I said, at the same time, I think the part of the reason I was there was to observe what it was really like on a movie set and meet John Houseman and, you know, have him assess if I had any kind of talent at all.
I mean, I remember being a kid in the theater, seeing movies at 10 years old, and I remember seeing the trailer for it. Like, even if it's not the most successful movie in the world, it's a, you know, part of the thing we sort of talk about on the show is like, it's the final film. Is there, you know, do they go out on like really on top or whatever? But it's, you know, yeah. So it's Ghost Story's not entirely successful, but it was a big production, and it was had a lot of attention. And again, it was great to see, you know, this film legend, Melvin Douglas, who you talked about, starred with everybody. And here he is with these three other legendary guys. And that's, you know, understate, you know, kind of underlining, look at the legendary figures we've got here for this film. They're not in it enough, but they're here. And what chance are you going to have to see these guys all in one spot, especially in 1981, for God's sakes?
Yeah. I wonder if there would be a recut I wonder if you could recut a version of the movie. I wonder if there's, you know, again, parts of the film that maybe were put on the cutting room floor. I wonder. I mean, that's why, again, I always wanted to meet Greg Wasson to have a discussion with him, you know, about it. You know, hearing his perspective and being there a little bit, I'd love to understand maybe what was, you know, what was going on. I do recall, as I said, that Patricia Neal talking about the director, and I think he was kind of insensitive and that abrupt, you know, that he had abruptness about him that was not conducive to doing your best acting.
Gotcha. Well, like I said, it was a real treat to go through so many of your grandfather's movies and see things I've never had a chance to see. And again, he's terrific in so many movies. I mean, earlier in his career, he's in The Vampire Bat, which is a lot of fun, and The Old Dark House, which is a classic. And then, so I mean, it's not at the they're not his first two films, but they're very early in his career. And he's got those sort of twin horror films. And then he basically doesn't do another horror film until his last couple of films, where he's got The Changeling and Ghost Story. So he's kind of like bookending his career with these horror features. But he said it was just an absolute delight to watch so many of these great movies that he was in. And it was a real it's a real honor to get to talk to you about this. I said it timed out perfectly that you had this book coming out, Connecticut in the Movies. I heartily recommend it to anybody that loves film. It's an enjoyable, it's a breezy read, and the thing I've been telling people about it is it reads like what it is talking to you. You know, it's not a dry recitation of plots and film criticism. It's someone giving you their view of these films with this thread, which is Connecticut. But I mean, I watch your Trailer from Hell's commentaries, and those are like little film schools because you do 5 minutes of intro before you get to the trailer, and you're giving all this context and stuff. And that's what the book is. And so it was really a highly entertaining read. And so I'm just really, really thrilled that I got to talk to you about the book and your grandfather's career.
Oh, thank you. Well, I appreciate it. And he's, you know, the only other movie of his I might suggest, two films of his that I really, really love, a little bit underseen. One I write about in the book, which is called Theodora Goes Wild. I
That's,
just
yeah, I watched that one. That was terrific.
terrific book, and this was a terrific film. This book right here is a book that he gave me. It's called Acting, The First Six Lessons. I mean, that's why I said this was his idea of like, you want to be an actor? It's like, well, I'm not going to help you get an agent, but here's a book on acting. So Richard Boleslavsky is the director of
Director,
Theodora
right?
Goes Wild and sadly died very young. Theodora Goes Wild is a completely naturalistic film, completely out of the different from the screwball comedies that were being made at the time, even though it's in the kind of the screwball genre. It's not at all screwball. And in fact, my grandfather always hated that phrase, which I always think is so funny. He just said, because we didn't call them screwballs, they were well-made comedies. And then the other movie of his that I love is called Too Many Husbands with Fred McMurray. And I just think it's a, and Jean Arthur. And it's just, it's so, it's got a crazy modern ending where Jean Arthur, it's got the, you know, the famous trope where, you know, her husband's lost on an island, so she remarries, and then the husband ends up coming back, and now she has to decide between the two men.
There we go. Now I get the title. There we go.
Exactly. And my grandfather, it's probably his wildest, like out on the edge, Melvin Douglas performance, but that's why I like it. It is really, I'd love to talk to him about it. Let's put it, there's a lot of like wearing, you know, women's lingerie, and there's a lot of that. It's like, okay. There's a
I've
lot
never
of sex.
seen that. You'll have to check that out.
It's really, really funny. That and Theodora Goes Wild, I highly, highly recommend if you're a Melvin Douglas fan.
Absolutely. Well, you heard her, everybody. Go check these movies out. A bunch of them are available across various streaming platforms. Like I said, I long for the days of a video store where I could have, my old video store had everything. So we had Loving, we had Let's Scare Jessica to Death, we had, we had all the. I would have made a little shelf of Connecticut movies, and I would have been so happy to sort of let people know about this book, because as I said, it's an absolutely terrific read, and it's part of my permanent film shelf now here here in the studio. So, well, again, thank you so much for doing this, Ileana. I'm a big fan of yours and a big fan of your grandfather. So it was just the thrill of a lifetime to get to talk to you about this.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Absolutely. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of the show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show in any podcatcher of your choice. We're always on Twitter and Blue Sky as Fade Out Pod. And if you want to support the networks, go to patreon.com/FW podcasts like Monique D did. So thanks so much for the support, Monique. So thanks for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script. So it's time to fade out.
Drop in and see us sometime.
Yeah, do that.